From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. Coming up, we call back that American teacher who survived the earthquake in China. Now she's helping with refugees.
These 300 children were packed on the floor like sardines in our office building. Most likely, they have told us that these children are orphans. They could not find their parents.
First to Iraq, where the war continues, we're going to hear a soldier's story.
The news from Iraq is almost never good. A ceasefire in Baghdad is breaking down again. There is more fighting with militias in the area called Sadr City. These are basically the same militias that were the target 2 months ago when Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki launched an offensive in the southern city of Basra.
That worked. Government troops are in control there now, but it was much more dangerous 4 years ago when British troops assigned to Basra were still battling suicide bombers and daily IED attacks.
Chris Hunter was there. In fact, he was the target of some of those IED attacks. Chris was a bomb disposal expert for the British Army. His job was to dismantle those roadside bombs before they exploded and without getting shot by a sniper in the process. He writes about his experience in a new book called 8 Lives Down. Chris Hunter, welcome to the program.
How are you, Madeline?
I'm fine, thank you. You had a lot of experience doing this bomb disposal before you even went to Iraq. You were in Colombia, you were in Northern Ireland, but I imagine the scale in Iraq would be 100 times what you saw in Colombia or Northern Ireland. What was a typical day like in Basra?
We'd sit there, and in our detachment room, the phone would suddenly ring. A tasking message would come through telling us there was an IED, where it was going to be, a rough description of what the device was like, although that was never, ever accurate. So you might as well just make it up.
And you were there in the summer of 2004, right?
That's right.
And, I imagine it was extremely hot, temperatures well above 100.
It got to a stage, actually, it was so hot that we couldn't wear the bomb suit. I couldn't wear the bomb suit. It was only myself, really, as the operator in the team. You're carrying that 85 pounds of bomb suit with Kevlar armor and all sorts of different armor and fire retardant material. And then you're probably carrying another 85 pounds of kit as well. And I'd have ended up probably keeling over from heat exhaustion and dying before I even got to the bomb itself. So in some ways, it was great, actually, that it was so hot because it actually reduced the amount of kit I had to carry by half.
Yeah, but it made it more dangerous.
That's right. Yeah, it did. Yeah.
So describe what it's like. You get out of the vehicle. You're not wearing your body armor because it's too hot, and you're walking along this dusty road by yourself.
That's it. I mean, you literally arrive there, and the first thing that happens is the team goes straight into their procedures, which is securing the area, checking for secondary devices. And then as soon as I'd established what I thought it was going to be down there, I'd send a robot down ideally, but much of the time it wasn't possible to do that because of the terrain. And then I'd go down and do a manual approach, which is what we call the long walk. And that's where you leave everybody else behind and you step out of that control point and do the long, lonely walk down the eerie street. You're absolutely focused on what you're doing. And not just the device, but, you know, the threat of secondary attack as well. So the threat of sniper attacks, the threat of secondary devices being emplaced along the route as you're walking up to that device.
You found out that you personally were being targeted by leaders of one of the militias, that they knew who you were, they knew what you were doing, what your position was, that you were dismantling their IEDs.
Yeah.
Who wanted to kill you, and how did they find out about you?
My particular team, we became very, very adept at not just neutralizing the devices themselves, but we were tasked to other incidents too. I mean, in the first 2 months, we were tasked to 45 incidents. And some of those incidents were explosions. But when we got there, you know, we wouldn't just say, yeah, there's a smoking hole in the ground. We would go and painstakingly gather the forensic evidence and put it together with the intelligence picture as well. And very, very quickly, we started building up an idea of what we call the terrorist signature, the bomb maker's signature, specific devices built by specific groups. And then when we fused that with the intelligence, we were able to identify the sort of areas they were operating from. And I was told basically that we'd been, you know, effectively insulting these Shias because they'd been made to look foolish because the devices they were emplacing weren't detonating because we were getting there quickly and interdicting them. And those that did, we were building up the forensic piece and making them look foolish. So they put a price on my head.
And it all came to a head for you with a massive hospital car bomb, a car bomb that was placed right near the entrance of a hospital. you find out later that, in fact, it was designed for you specifically.
That's right, yeah. They knew that we wouldn't be able to evacuate a hospital, so I would therefore have to go and deal with the device by hand. What I did instead was actually get into the hospital and evacuate everyone to the back of the hospital so they'd be behind cover. And then I escaped out through a side window, went back to my control point and sent the robot down there. And I said to everyone in the team, I'm just going to pop the trunk of this car. You'll just hear a slight pop as I pop it open. But of course, the entire opening mechanisms were booby-trapped.
Can you read a passage from that incident?
Yes, certainly. There's a pause, then a blinding, searing flash as the car explodes in a whirlwind of fire and shrapnel. The earth-shaking roar makes the ground tremble beneath our feet, and then the shockwave hits us. I feel my eardrums go and my body judder as I'm smashed into the side of the snatch vehicle behind me. I steady myself. My ears are ringing. There's smoke and flame everywhere. A cloud of flying glass and debris fills the air around us. Distorted metal panels spiral skywards. A gearbox lands nearby, the force of its impact burying it right into the tarmac. And then silence. 40 meters away, there's a huge smoking crater where the car detonated, fringed with fiercely burning petrol. The hospital reception area is trashed. Doors and wall panels are hanging off their hinges, and the whole place is covered in glass. Thank God we evacuated them. They'd have been cut to pieces if they'd stayed in there.
That was your last assignment.
That was, yeah, that's right.
You were pulled off the job because your boss basically said, that's it, I don't want you to die.
That's it, yeah. He said, basically, you know, you've done enough, and you're now obviously, you know, compromising the team as well.
So you're pulled off that job for your safety and assigned to gathering intelligence. And what did you discover? Where were these bombs coming from, and who was making them?
You know, there were 650,000 tons of explosive ordnance, ammunition stockpiles in the country when we moved in 2003. We managed to capture about 250,000 tons of that. But, you know, there was still 400,000 tons left lying around the country. So the insurgents were using that as the main explosive charges. And then just using everyday electronic items, things like, you know, the car entry systems that you get into your car, the radio control opening devices, you know, we're using cell phones, radios, anything at all they could. So they were coming from, you know, everyday items in shipments from, you know, normal legal supplies. But there was also a dimension from Iran. And those weren't everyday items. Those were devices being used by Lebanese Hezbollah against the Israelis. And Lebanese Hezbollah had provided them to the Iranians. And then between them, they were shipping them into to southern Iraq. And those devices, they're called explosive form penetrators. They're the most lethal IEDs we've ever seen on Earth. To sort of put it into context, in the 30 years that we were fighting in Britain against the Provisional IRA, the level of sophistication they achieved in 30 years was superseded in Iraq in 12 months. Now it's the most technologically advanced insurgency in the world, and we're seeing the same thing in Afghanistan too.
You volunteered to go to Iraq. You weren't assigned to go to Iraq. You wanted to go.
Absolutely.
Why?
I mean, I was the analogy I use is that, you know, imagine training to be a surgeon. Imagine going through all that med school and then all the other training that you need to become a surgeon, and then never ever carrying out an operation on a person. And that's what it's like as a soldier or sailor or an airman, you know. It's you do all this training, but to never actually go and be able to practice it for real would, you know, be a bit of a shame. So for every serviceman and woman, I think, you know, they when the opportunity comes up to go on operations, that's what it's all about. But eventually you get to a stage where, you know, you've got to question what's most important. And for me, it got to a stage where I'd been doing the job that I loved for many, many years, but it was having such an adverse effect on my family. EOD is also known as everyone's divorce, not just explosive ordnance disposal, and I wanted to make sure that wasn't going to be me. So
you went back to England. Are you still married?
Yes, yeah, we're still happily married, and we've got two beautiful daughters too.
Do you miss it? Do you want to go back to Iraq?
If you'd have asked me just a couple of months ago, I'd have said no. But I left the British military about 18 months ago. And now I've got to a stage where I'm missing it desperately. And I think effectively what happens is, you know, we say to ourselves, well, the grass is greener on the other side. I'm going to get out and I'm going to do this for my family. And, you know, it was amazing. We moved to the area we wanted to move to. We settled the children down in school permanently rather than, you know, moving around every 2 years as we had done in the military. We live near old friends. It's, you know, it's wonderful. But for me, it's got to a stage now where actually I've realised we can't fundamentally change the people we are. And I think I'm probably, well, I am going to go back out to Afghanistan in about 2 months' time, just to go and do some contractor work out there.
What does your wife think of that?
She's not entirely thrilled, but Lucy is actually, she's very supportive of it. We've talked long and hard about it, and I'm not going to be going out there for too long, probably just a few months. I don't feel content now. I don't feel entirely sort of settled in this beautiful idyllic lifestyle we've got. And I think I probably just need to go and finally get it out of my system. You know, going from doing this for 12 years of a 17-year career to doing nothing has been very different to the way I anticipated it would be. So I'll go and do it for a couple of months. And then I'm pretty certain I'm going to definitely settle down for good after that.
Haven't you said that before?
Kind of, yeah.
Chris Hunter, he's the author of the new book, Eight Lives Down. It's about his experience in Basra in 2004, dismantling roadside bombs for the British Army. Chris Hunter, thank you very much.
Thanks very much indeed for your time.
There's an excerpt from Chris Hunter's book at our website, npr.org.
Earlier this week, we profiled an American soldier, Captain Nate Rawlings, who recently shipped back to Iraq for his second deployment. He is in Sadr City now in Baghdad. You can send him questions by going to npr.org/Nate. We're going to read some of your questions and hear a couple of Nate's email responses tomorrow on the show.